The next case on the calendar is in re the matter of welfare of the child of JBM and AA. It's A19-0902. Are the attorneys here for that case?
We have the attorneys here.
Thank you.
Does it matter on which side I'm?
Are you willing to respond?
I'm the respondent.
You're over there then, thanks.
Thank you.
And I see that we have the former chief judge of the Fifth Judicial District here.
Thanks for coming down, folks. Appreciate you.
Well, it's good to see a friendly face out there. Looks like retirement is agreeing with you.
Not complaining. I was here yesterday working, so they picked me off today.
But you came back like a busman's holiday, right?
Comes to Noble's County enough, in his retirement.
I can almost vote in Noble's County.
And I see two people at the appellant's table. Are you both arguing or only one?
Just me, Travis.
Yeah, okay, thanks. Once you get situated, we're ready to start. You'll each have 15 minutes from your argument with 5 minutes for rebuttal. And when you begin your argument, please state your name for the record. We're recording all of these proceedings.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith, and I represent appellants JBM and AA in this appeal from the termination of their parental rights. Appellants' parental rights were terminated here solely on the basis of the statutory presumption of palpable unfitness due to a previous termination under Minnesota Statute Section 260C-301, Subdivision 1, Parents B, Parents 4. The district court assumed that in order to rebut the presumption of palpable unfitness, a previously terminated parent must produce evidence that they have corrected the conditions that led to the previous termination. But that's not the standard that's applicable here. Minnesota law does not permit prophylactic termination of parental rights. But indeed, that's exactly what seems to have happened in this case. And I would assert that that's exactly what respondent is arguing for here.
I want to make sure that I understand your position. The mother did not produce any evidence. Or are you saying the evidence was produced through the father?
That's correct. I'm saying that the evidence was produced through the father and also through the testimony, particularly on cross-examination, of the social worker, Jessica Viscotch.
And what would that evidence be? I understand your position with regard to what the father's evidence was, but I'm trying to understand what evidence the mother produced.
She would have produced the same evidence. In fact, the father testified that she was caring for the child, that they were working together to improve their parenting skills and to work on learning ways of dealing with discipline. Also, there's testimony that the child was being adequately cared for. There were no reports of abuse or neglect.
We're talking about a 6-day period, right?
We are talking about a 6-day period, but that 6-day period is because of the county's actions of removing the child at that time.
Right, but you're suggesting that it indicates an ability to parent, and it's some evidence, but seems to be not particularly, given the nature of the issues that led to the prior terminations, 6 days is not, probably not to say that all of those conditions have been addressed.
But my very quarrel with it, my very quarrel is with saying that those conditions have to be addressed in order to rebut the presumption, because that's what we're talking about here. That's what that is at issue here.
As counsel, the presumption exists because the parents' rights have been terminated with regard to another child, correct?
Correct.
And so there were grounds for that termination.
The district court in the previous case found that there were grounds for that termination, yes.
And to rebut the presumption under JAK, the parent has to produce enough evidence to support a finding that the parent is suitable to be entrusted with the care of the children. So isn't it necessary to consider the prior termination to be able to demonstrate that the parent is suitable to be entrusted with the care of the children? Because there was a reason that the court found that the parent was previously not fit to parent. And so it seems to me, in order to demonstrate that you're currently fit, you need that the past determination necessarily must be considered.
I don't believe the statute supports that approach, because to be palpably unfit is to be palpably unfit as to a particular child, given the statutory definition of what palpable unfitness is.
But it's also tied to conditions related to those children.
Right. To the particular child that's the subject of the action.
And so then your argument would be that the court, that there's a fresh slate, and that the presumption isn't tethered to the grounds for the prior termination.
That's correct. And I think that that's important in order to bear in mind the fact that this, the presumption has to be easily rebuttable in order for this presumption to even survive strict scrutiny.
Well, in JAK, though, the court considered the grounds for the prior termination and addressed whether the parent had made meaningful changes in regards to those, the prior reasons for the termination. So doesn't JAK support that you look to the prior termination in determining whether the presumption has been rebutted? It is easily rebuttable, but JAK suggests you look to the prior grounds.
I don't think so for two reasons. First, in JAK, I think it's important to point out that this court held that that parent had presented substantial evidence. Moreover, as I argued in the brief, or in my reply brief, JAK, in a footnote, specifically said it called into question this court's prior jurisprudence, holding the parents to a much higher standard where they had to affirmatively approve their ability to parent in order to rebut the presumption. It didn't specifically abrogate those cases, which suggests to me that JAK must have met the higher standard articulated in the older cases.
Let's talk about the facts of this case, where I was a judge for 7 years in Hennepin County District Court. And I can tell you, I only had a handful of cases where a child said they never wanted to see a parent again, which is what happened in this case on the prior termination. And in that case, there were findings that your clients were culpably unfit because of the physical punishment meted out to the children. And so here we had an infant. And we have the same judge on both cases. And so what is that judge supposed to do with the knowledge of the prior case and what happened to those children, not as 6-day-old infants, but when they were able to talk and disobey or whatever the parents thought they were doing?
I think that judge is required to set that knowledge aside or recuse themselves if they can't.
I don't know where that argument comes from. I mean, I also served as a district court judge doing these kinds of cases, and we particularly had one judge assigned to one family so that there would be this kind of continuity. I mean, it seems like your argument taken to its logical conclusion is, yeah, a new judge, completely ignore why the prior TPR exists and wait for this child to be gone. I just can't believe that that's the intent of the statute.
The statute's language is clear. In order to prove palpable unfitness, you have to prove conditions or conduct related to the child who's the subject of the action.
Well, counsel, let's look at the language of paragraph B4. 260C.301B4. It talks about, it says that a parent is palpably unfit to be a party to the parent and child relationship because of a consistent pattern of specific conduct before the child or of specific conditions relating to the parent and child relationship. And I'll stop there. But the first part of that clause is a pattern of specific conduct before the child. So couldn't that be interpreted to mean conduct happening that the parent engaged in before the child was born?
No, it cannot. Because the Minnesota Supreme Court has consistently said that the conduct has to be related to this child.
Except that
it's not a temporal reference, it's something that's happening in the presence of the children, is the meaning of before that I would assert is being used there.
So how does the presumption then function as a practical matter?
The presumption functions to initially relieve the state, the county of the need to prove the conduct that's set forth in subdivision 1B4. But when the parents meet their easy burden of production to rebut that presumption, it's done.
And how did the parent here, particularly father, because father's the only one who really put evidence in, it seems to me, about his ability to parent. What was that competent evidence that indicated he was able to parent this very young child?
But the competent evidence was the fact that he was actually parenting this very young child.
For 6 days.
For 6 days.
What was the other competent evidence?
The other competent evidence was his testimony about the efforts he's made to address his mental health issues to...
The two therapy sessions, right? I mean, actually, what is the exact evidence?
He had attended two therapy sessions, but he went out of his way to make sure that he got mental health services. He made contact with a mental health center, and then when he was put on a waiting list and didn't hear, he followed up. And
did he do that after the child was removed from the home?
I think he did that after the child was removed from the home.
So after the first termination of parental rights, he didn't do anything in terms of seeking mental health services until after this second, until after the current child was removed from the home.
I'm not 100% certain on that. I'll take some time and I'll try to address the rebuttal.
This is the thing that, excuse me,
go ahead.
Finish up.
Oh, I think the district court remarked that it seemed like the steps he took were only after the child was removed, and they weren't particularly meaningful steps. And that he failed to acknowledge any real concerns about his parenting practices.
And I don't think it's true that he failed to acknowledge any concerns about his parenting practices.
He steadfastly, it seems, denied that he had physically abused the old two children.
First of all, I think that was irrelevant. That was objected to on relevance grounds. And that wasn't evidence that was presented by him. That was an inquiry that was made by counsel for the respondent that was objected to.
I still don't understand your legal basis for saying how a parent was with older children or other children has no bearing on how the parent is going to be with this particular child. So please point me to some legal basis for that claim.
And again, I think the plain language of the statute is the legal basis for that claim. And the tense shift in the verb is important here.
Even though it says the child, how you're going to interact with one child is your interactions with other children reflect how you will interact with any other child.
If that's the way...
Do you agree with that? Regardless of whether someone's parental rights have been terminated, isn't it true that how I interact with my first child might affect how I interact with my second child as a parent?
I can agree that it might, but that's highly speculative. We're talking about the termination of parental rights and a presumption that must be easily rebuttable to survive strict scrutiny. Maybe an example from literature might help. Cinderella and her evil stepmother. this, I think, illustrates the point, because you could have two children who are being parented by the same parent contemporaneously, and the parent is palpably unfit to parent one of the children, but not the other. The conduct towards the other child, unless it rises to the level of egregious harm, is not admissible or relevant to prove whether that parent is palpably unfit to parent the other child. It shouldn't...
Well, isn't that the whole basis of a presumption, that the inability to safely parent other children, you're presumed that you can't... I mean, I don't understand how your argument that that's not relevant, when in fact that's the reason we have a presumption.
We have a presumption, which is based on a bare judicial fact. The bare judicial fact of termination.
Of palpable unfitness.
Of palpable unfitness. But if we go down the road of saying effectively you have to prove that the conditions that led to the previous termination have been corrected, the burden is no longer easy to rebut, and we're back to the pre-RDL and pre-JAK jurisprudence of this court.
Except that JAK did a whole lot more before having another baby than either of your clients did.
That is certainly true, but again, this court pointed out that that was substantial evidence. It can't be the bare minimum to meet a burden of production. The district court here confused a burden of production with a burden of persuasion.
So I want to get back to my earlier question. What was the competent evidence? It's father's testimony that I set up mental health treatment. I've been to two sessions. What else had he done?
He had read and studied parenting techniques. He identified specific books that he had read, identified things that he had learned, and he testified to all of those things.
And then he also testified, I don't think I was inappropriate with the other children. So doesn't that negate his own testimony that he had addressed the issue?
Then we get into the question of whether you can make credibility determinations and weigh evidence to determine whether a burden of production has been rebutted.
How is that a credibility determination? It's considering the totality of the evidence and considering his own words.
I think it is, because you're picking and choosing which evidence to give weight to. And it might not be strictly a credibility determination.
That's different than a credibility determination.
But the Supreme Court has repeatedly said that not only can you not make credibility determinations, you also can't weigh evidence to determine whether a burden of production has been met.
But you have to look at the evidence as a whole.
Certainly, but you can't then pick and choose which parts of the evidence you want to consider.
Didn't the judge, though, consider all of his testimony? The judge recognized that he'd read books, that he'd been to therapy sessions, but still, based on the evidence as a whole, concluded that he had not rebutted the presumption.
I see my time has expired. May I answer
the question, then you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I don't think that the district court considered the testimony as a whole. I don't think it actually gave the proper consideration to the evidence presented by appellant, because it discounted parts of his testimony. And it was required to view the evidence in the light most favorable to appellants in determining whether they rebutted the presumption. And it completely failed to do that, and accordingly held the appellants to too high a burden. Accordingly, I would ask this court to reverse. Thank you.
Counsel?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Brayden Holford. I'm an assistant county attorney with the Nobles County Attorney's Office.
Could you please spell your name?
Yes, it's V-R-A-D-E-N, last name H-O-E-F-E-R-T.
Thank you.
And I'm here representing the respondents, the Nobles County Community Services Agency. As the court knows, Mr. Smith frequently appears on behalf of Nobles County as a special assistant. And so it's good to be here with Mr. Smith on opposite sides of this issue this time. I wanted to address a couple of the points that Mr. Smith and the appellants made. First, regarding the meaning of Minnesota Statute 260C301, Subdivision 1B4. I can see where Mr. Smith is coming from with regard to the first part of that statute, which says a parent's palpably unfit because of a consistent pattern of specific conduct before the child. So one can see how that could be interpreted as a specific child. But clear in the meaning of the second phrase, or of specific conditions directly relating to the parent and child relationship. And so the appellants take the definite article, the, there, and say it applies to the child. What it actually applies to is the parent and child relationship. And so, for instance, if you have a parent who is a murderer and who murders the mother of the child, that parent is nonetheless palpably unfit because that is a specific condition, the nature of which renders that parent palpably unfit. And so under this, the standard advocated for by the appellants, they would argue that because the parent had not murdered the child, that parent is not culpably unfit, and that is obviously an absurd result.
Even if we agree with you, why isn't the evidence here that father had sought out, enrolled in therapy, attended a couple of sessions, was reading books about parenting, and expressed his desire and commitment to being an effective, safe parent for this youngest infant? Why isn't that sufficient to meet the burden of production?
That's a good question and a legitimate question. Certainly the burden has been phrased as an easy one. As I say in my brief, it's not an automatic one. And so I don't know if the court had a chance to see the case that Mr. Smith and the appellants provided a notice of last night. But there was a similar question in that case, which was JD and BD. And the court in that case found that evidence that the mother made efforts to find treatment programs, that she enjoyed spending time with the child, that her behavior was acceptable while visiting the child in supervised settings, was not enough to meet even an easy standard. And so that was a case where a mother was a heroin user and struggled with heroin addiction.
That is in this case different because this case involves discipline, and here the father has stated that he recognizes that that the discipline that he has taken an oath not to use physical discipline and recognizes there's differences in what is considered appropriate discipline in this country than the country he was born in. So doesn't that demonstrate an understanding of change on his part?
Well, it doesn't. And if you look at the transcript, I asked him definitively, what did you engage in the prior case, which was with two children who were physically abused, verbally abused, emotionally abused. What did you do in that previous case that through your new understanding you now realize is inappropriate? And the one example he gave was taking tablets away from children. And I asked him, is there anything else? And he could not think of a single example of what he had done to these two previous children who the court has alluded to. Suffered severe physical abuse, and he couldn't think of a single example. And so to analogize with the BD and JD case with the heroin user, it would be akin to that mother, where the record was ample of her heroin addiction, testifying in order to rebut the presumption, I was never a heroin user. I never used heroin. I'm seeking out treatment. I'm looking at treatment, but I've never used heroin. Would that be sufficient to rebut the presumption? Of course it would not. And so the father here testifying, I'm reading a book while also admitting that he hadn't learned from it yet. I haven't abused the child while I've been having supervised visits. And also physical violence with the older children never happened. That is, to answer your question, Judge Bjorkman, of Mr. Smith, that is kind of the pertinent evidence, and that fails to meet even an easy burden because it doesn't actually rebut the presumption. It actually reinforces the presumption.
But Mr. Smith argues that the presumption should be untethered to the grounds for the original termination on culpable unfitness grounds. Why is he wrong?
Well, if the court looks at really any case law involving a presumption and a TPR, even before RDL, I realize that the standard has kind of changed, but that aspect hasn't. And really, in every case involving a presumption, the trial court wants to know, what have you done? And so the cases say it's on a case-by-case basis. And so if you have someone who's a heroin user, you don't look for evidence that their house is clean and they have a crib and they have a job. You look for, well, what are you doing to address your addiction? In this case, the parents engaged in physical, verbal, emotional abuse of a little boy and a little girl. You look to, what have you done to acknowledge that? What have you done to learn from it? And are you going to do it again? And the district court found in the first case that there was a refusal to acknowledge what had happened, a blaming of the little boy and the little girl for what had happened. And that's what I mean when I say that the appellant father's testimony didn't rebut that presumption, it reinforced it, because basically he continued to say it didn't happen. And
but he also said that he wouldn't engage in any physical discipline and that he's been reading books to learn how to parent appropriately. And as appellant points out, as appellant argues, the court should look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the parent in terms of whether the presumption has been rebutted. So why isn't that sufficient?
He did say those things, and that goes to the point of a credibility determination. I don't think that it is a credibility determination, which would be saying, I believe the government's witnesses, I disbelieve the appellant's witnesses, therefore the appellant did not meet his burden of production, which of course would be inappropriate. But if you look at a case that I analogized in the brief, Foster v. Jessen, which is a commitment case, the appellant in that case was a committed person, and he offered testimony from a Dr. Reitman saying that he was suitable to be transferred to a less restrictive facility. Then that same doctor later testified, oh, he actually hasn't done a polygraph, so actually, no, he's not suitable. And the court found that the committed person hadn't met his burden of production. So he appealed, and this court didn't say, well, he changed his mind, but technically there is evidence, however minute, in the record that he's suitable for transfer, so therefore he met his burden of production. What the court said is you look at the evidence as a whole, and the record as a whole does not support.
Do you agree with Mr. Smith that you shouldn't be making, or district court shouldn't be making credibility determinations during rebutting the presumption stage?
No, I didn't. I would disagree with the way the appellants have phrased it, which is a per se rule. The appellants don't actually argue that it was inappropriate in this case. They argue that it's inappropriate per se. That a court, and that's what Mr. Smith argued here today, is that the court is not to be making credibility determinations per se. But that's not what the law actually says. If the court looks at the cases cited by the appellants, Coker particularly, says the burden of production does not generally allow a credibility assessment. As a general matter, a district court should not engage in weighing of the evidence when deciding whether someone rebutted a presumption. A burden of production requires a committed person to come forward with competent evidence. But the Supreme Court in Jacobson said, we decline the appellant's invitation to adopt a per se rule prohibiting inconsideration of witness credibility. And so effectively what the appellants are doing is asking this court to adopt that per se rule that the Supreme Court specifically refused to adopt. And the Supreme Court said that we do this because we can envision cases in which some consideration of witness credibility may be important or even essential, such as when an appellant's only evidence is his own testimony. No reasonable finder of fact would believe that testimony. And so appellants have yet to argue why it was inappropriate in this case when you have testimony from only one witness, that testimony is not corroborated.
But the testimony of the parent who is writing.
The testimony of
the parent. I mean, would this be a different case if the therapist with whom father met on two occasions had submitted a report saying, gosh, we have a breakthrough, he really is committed, mean, would that be a different situation where arguably district court could have reached a different result?
Absolutely. And so when you're talking about it being an easy burden, it is possible for it to be an easy burden, yet for parents not to be able to meet it. And so you can imagine that by imagining what the evidence could have been. That's one thing. The father also could have testified, I did engage in abuse that was inappropriate, and through my understanding, I came to realize that, and here are the steps that I've taken. I'm not a perfect parent, but I realized what I did was wrong. I'm not going to do it again. I'm going to be a better father. That's not what I said. And so that is something that can be considered. On the point of credibility, the appellants have yet to point out why it was inappropriate in this case when you have a father who is testifying to something which the district court, the same judge, as a matter of fact, already found to be true, which is that the appellants engaged in child abuse over a prolonged period of time towards this little boy and this little girl. So when you have a father who comes and testifies that that never happened, can the court consider that credibility of that statement, or does the court have to accept it as true? Because it's a fact that's already been adjudicated. And interestingly enough, the appellants don't argue that the court has to accept that testimony as true. But if the court doesn't have to accept that as true, then you are engaging in at least a de minimis amount of credibility. And further, if you're accepting that that's not true, then is that something that the court can consider in determining the overall credibility and whether the parents have introduced evidence that's sufficient to sustain a finding that they can be trusted with the care and custody of this infant, of this infant child?
So in your view, is evidence of parenting for 6 days of any child, of a child, not this child, but just a child in particular, sufficient to support a finding that a parent is suitable to be entrusted with the care of the child?
No, it's not sufficient by itself. Certainly it could be sufficient along with other grounds, like I indicated, things that the father could have testified. JAK, as the appellants point out, is not the minimum barrier. Certainly that parent introduced substantial evidence that it was clear that the burden had been, the presumption had been rebutted. That evidence can be considered, and certainly had they shaken the child, that would be relevant in establishing that they hadn't rebutted the presumption. The fact that the child was not hurt by them in 6 days is relevant. I don't know how persuasive it is. And so certainly in the case of JP and BD, you had a parent who largely interacted with their child in controlled settings, and that's here. The court, as your honors know well, in TPR cases does look into the future to see how this parent is likely to do. And so the fact that you have an infant child, you're not just looking for today, you're looking into the future. And what would these parents, what did they demonstrate that they could do in the things that they did between cases? So I ask the court to not overturn the district court's order. Thank you.
Mr. Smith?
Thank you. I want to start first by trying to keep my promise to Judge Cochran. I looked at the transcript. To the best that I can tell, it's not real clear, but there's no concrete evidence that the steps were taken before the removal of the child. So I can't stand here and say that my clients took steps before the removal of the child. At best, the record's unclear. I want to begin by first addressing a specific point that Respondents' Counsel made, and that's about the parent-child relationship. First of all, the Supreme Court, I believe, has consistently interpreted the in the parent-child relationship to mean this parent-child relationship, not previous parent-child relationships. And in particular, to the hypothetical of a domestic abuse murder, I would point this court to, in the matter of the welfare of MDO, at 462 Northwest 2nd 370, and I'll do the respondent one better. In that case, the appellant mother was convicted of second-degree murder of a child. The Minnesota Supreme Court held that the district court erred, or that this court erred when it reversed the district court's refusal to terminate based on that fact. So respond to this, the county in that case was arguing that the fact that the appellant had been convicted of second-degree murder of a previous child demonstrated they were palpably unfit to parent the current child, a newborn. The district court said no and refused to terminate. This court reversed the district court, and the Minnesota Supreme Court overturned this court's reversal and affirmed the refusal to terminate. So the simple fact that a parent has engaged in the most egregious of violence against someone in their family before is not by itself sufficient as a matter of law to justify termination.
That's why the presumption can be rebutted.
Correct.
Right.
And that was, I would know MDO as a pre-RDL and a pre-JA case, JAK case. I also want to talk about JD because I put a notice of supplemental authority. I know it's an unpublished decision, but what I thought was particularly apropos about JD was the fact that it demonstrated that appellant's interpretation of the statute, that you actually have to show conduct before the current child, is not absurd, doesn't result in the presumption being ineffective. What's particularly noteworthy, and I think the most significant fact for this court in that case, was the fact that the appellant there, JD, continued to use heroin while she was pregnant with the child who was the subject of the action. There was clearly a pattern of conduct before the child who was the subject of the action that demonstrated palpable unfitness. And she, it's in that context of her continued use while pregnant that you consider the light of her, that you consider her steps after that. This court didn't focus on the long history before that. What was really
significant? Was the prior TPR based on heroin use?
The prior TPR was based on heroin use, but again, what matters is that conduct. And so the appellant's interpretation of the statute here is not unreasonable, and it doesn't result in absurdity. So I think that's important to bear in mind. Finally, with regard to Foster v. Jessen, I would point out that in Foster v. Jessen, the doctor's testimony was initially conditional or equivocal. It was, if he's done the full disclosure polygraph, then I would recommend this. As the testimony developed, it was clear that he didn't do that, and so the doctor testified in light of that, no, I don't recommend, I think it was transfer. So that's important to bear in mind there, that we're not talking about conflicts within the testimony. We're not talking about rejecting part and accepting part. We're talking about to look at it in a whole and see that it makes sense because we had conditional testimony, additional facts, and then saying the natural consequence of the condition.
Well, as a whole, how does father's testimony make sense in showing that he is suitable to be entrusted with the care of a child when he, on the one hand, says that he never engaged in physical abuse of the two prior children, and on the other hand says that he did spank the child once. And so he's being inconsistent himself.
Well, and again, those to the extent there are inconsistencies in his testimony, the inconsistencies have to be resolved in favor of appellant because this is a burden of production. So that's the way it has to be resolved. The evidence has to be viewed in the light most favorable to the appellant.
So you're suggesting we ignore his testimony that he never abused the other children?
Yes, for purposes of determining whether the burden of production is rebutted, yes, the court has to ignore that testimony. And if I can just hit one more point, the respondent has argued that I have not asserted a per se rule regarding credibility determinations. I have. I think that's clearly articulated in the brief. And I think even Foster v. Jessen is consistent with a per se rule.
So then we would allow, because really the only testimony here is father's. I mean, yes, the social worker said 6 days the child wasn't injured, but the district court just needs to accept a parent's testimony as true, even though that parent's parental rights have been twice terminated and the parent's testimony doesn't acknowledge that prior.
Yes, for purposes of determining whether the burden of production is rebutted, absolutely.
And even where it's directly contrary to the district court's findings in the prior termination?
Yes. I don't think the Supreme Court's jurisprudence admits of anything different.
So doesn't that render the presumption meaningless?
No, as...
Whenever a parent shows up and offers testimony, whether credible or not?
As JD demonstrates, I don't think it renders the presumption meaningless.
Well, how can a court determine based on a child being with a parent for only 6 days that parent is suitable to be entrusted with the care of the child? 6 days is so short, and there were serious concerns that led to this parent's parental rights being terminated as to the other child. And so how can that be sufficient to show that the parent is suitable to be entrusted with the care of the child? That, you know, that evidence along with him going to a therapist twice.
First of all, I disagree that that's all of the evidence in the record. So
I understand he testified that he read some books, but on the other hand, how is him reading those books even relevant if you're saying we shouldn't consider what happened in the prior termination? I mean, you seem to be suggesting we should just ignore that this prior termination ever happened and we just need to look at this parent today.
No, I'm not suggesting that we ignore that the prior termination happened. I concede that we have to wrestle with the fact that the prior termination happened. That's what gives rise to the presumption. What he testifies to about what he's learned about parenting is relevant to his ability to parent this child, regardless of whether he's made mistakes in the past or not, or what specific mistakes he's made in the past. So it is relevant, and it has to be viewed in a light most favorable to the appellant. And the district court refused to do that, and it erred in doing so. It's clear that the prior TPR so colored the district court's analysis of this case that it didn't apply the proper standard.
Even if his parental rights hadn't been terminated, he was the parent of another child, and he co-parented the second child involved in that other case. And so, you know, he has a history of parenting. Isn't that relevant to determining whether he's suitable to be entrusted with the care of the child, this current child?
No, it is not, because palpable unfitness, the only statutory grounds alleged here, requires conduct related to this child. That goes back to the fact that unless you have an egregious harm...
But he has to show that he's suitable to be entrusted to care for this child going forward, and...
He doesn't have to prove that.
Well,
to rebut his presumption, he has to raise a genuine question of fact.
He has to produce only enough evidence to support a finding that the parent is suitable to be entrusted with the care of the children. I'm quoting from JAK.
And there's competing articulations of that standard in JAK. There's that language, and then there's the language that you just have to raise a question of fact.
Thank you. The case has been well briefed, well argued, and we will have our decision out within the statute.